So I have this book here. You may have heard of it before. I have a question about it. Well, I have a few questions about it. And this isn't to so that we can judge each other or anything like that, but I'm curious to know if or how many people have ever read through this entire thing, this Bible. Okay? And how many people have read any of it? Okay, great. Just curious what you think about this book. Yeah, what do you think about it? Awesome. Sometimes it's confusing. Better than the movie. Yeah, that's pretty much true.
It's the manual for life.
Manual for life, okay. Okay, thank you. Great segue. So Sheila says she only reads the New Testament, and she knows that we're about to talk about the Old Testament, and I applaud you for moving out of your comfort zone and coming to a series that's going to be about the Old Testament. We are going to spend all of Lent in the Old Testament, and we are going to try to talk about the whole thing, which is more than half of this book. So I will try to keep these talks approximately the same length that they usually are, but please forgive me if they get a little bit longer, because there's a whole lot to cover. So we'll just get that out of the way. But I would say that this book is a story. It is a story about love and about betrayal and about pain. And like most of the best stories that there are in the world, there are really strong emotions. There are really big things that happen. There's a whole lot of humanness, and there's also redemption and eventual resolution. The Bible is a compilation of a lot of stories. You may know that it's made up of different books that were written by different people, but Christians have traditionally believed that, and this church teaches, that this book is different from other books. It is uniquely inspired by God. And so these stories, even though they were written over a vast period of time and they're written by a whole bunch of different people, in some way God inspired each of these writers to write down something that God wanted us to know about what it is to be human in relationship to God. And it's a story, most of all. A lot of times we think it's about do's and don'ts, or it's a whole list of rules, or it's, you know, very little of the book is about that. Most of it is a story. So it's a bunch of different little stories, but they all together make one big story. So how about stories in general? Do you guys like stories? What are some of the usual elements of a story, the things that most stories have in common? Plot, hopefully. There are some TV shows out there that I'm not sure they realize that that's supposed to be a part of a story, but yeah. A beginning, a middle, and end, a hero, climax, resolution, people, yeah. What's that? Characters. So yeah, so let's talk about the beginning, middle, end, and the climax part first. Here's my premise for this entire series. Everything in the Bible is there in some way to point to, or in the New Testament, to explain the good news about Jesus. Everything. The gospel is only good news, really, or it only makes sense. It only has an internal logic when we have a basic understanding of the entire flow of the Bible. If you try to get at the gospel without the Old Testament, it's like coming into the story right at the climax. And so you'll get the action that everything was pointing to, but you have no idea what happened before to get you to that place. So then there are all these kind of underlying questions, whether we think to ask them or not. Wait, why did God have to become a human? Who's this Jesus guy? What is he doing here? Why did he have to die? Why is sin so bad? What even is sin? So conversely, Jewish people might disagree, but I would argue that the Old Testament only makes sense if it culminates in Jesus. If you leave out the New Testament, it's like quitting the book or the movie right before the climax. Which sometimes Paul and I will do that. We like to binge watch TV series, and if we know that the season is going to end, but there's not the next season, Paul hates the cliffhanger. So he'll say, okay, we're going to stop at the second to last episode, and we're going to wait to watch the last episode of this season until the next season comes out, because I don't want to wait months and months to find out what's going to happen next. But that is kind of what happened with the Bible. The Old Testament was written, all this stuff happened, and it built up, and it built up, and it drops on a cliffhanger, and then there's 400 years of nothing. And then the next season starts. Jesus shows up, right? So it's okay to have the break, but eventually you have to get to what all the stuff that came before is leading to, right? So the whole Bible, we need the whole thing. If we're going to be followers of Jesus, we need all of it. Can God save a person who only has a copy of, say, like the book of Matthew? Sure. God can do anything. He can do whatever he wants. But God is a God who speaks, and he wants us to know that because that's what he does. That's the first thing he does in the first chapter of the first book of the Bible, right? He's a God who speaks, and he spoke this book and our entire universe into existence. He didn't make the world for no reason, and he didn't inspire this book for no reason. The universe was created out of the overflowing love of God. He created everything because he loves, his essence is love. We've talked about that before. And if that's true, then we can imagine that the Bible was also inspired out of the overflowing love of God. And this is an important thing to keep in mind because there are some kind of disturbing things in the Old Testament. And when we read it, we need to remember, okay, I don't understand this. This is confusing. This sounds horrible. I don't know, but I know that God's essence is love. So somehow, even if I can't understand this piece right now, and I can't understand how that fits in with a loving God, somehow it does, because this too came from him, and his essence is love. All right, so some other elements in the story that you guys mentioned. Characters. There's usually main characters, and then there's some like bad guys, and you could say the hero and the villain, or you could say the protagonist and the antagonist. That's the fancy literature version of those words. So I would say there's two main characters in this story that God is telling. There's God, and then there's humans, kind of as a whole. And there are two villains or two antagonists. The accuser, sometimes known as Satan, and also humans. We're both. Lucky us. There's also, most stories have a conflict, and there is an ongoing conflict in this story, and the central ongoing conflict in the story is God versus idols, God versus counterfeits. Idolatry is the problem in the Bible. It's still the problem. Now, God, the hero of the story, the lover, is trying to woo us away from our abusive idol boyfriends. Basically, that's one synopsis of the Bible. And sorry, men, in the biblical symbolism, God is the man in this equation and humans are the woman. So if we're using that symbolism, that's how you break down that story. Sometimes idols are literal statues in the Old Testament world. That was mostly what idols were. They were statues that represented some kind of spiritual power, and usually that spiritual power was an existing power that did not have humans' best interest at heart. It's not, the story of the conflict of the Bible is who wins the human heart. And God is trying to woo us. God is trying to win our hearts. And the powers that oppose God are not trying to win our hearts. They could care less about our hearts. They just don't want God to have them. So this is the spiritual struggle, the cosmic struggle that's going on. We don't see it, but it affects our lives every single day. And sometimes the idols are these powers, and sometimes they are our own selves. Our authority, our personalities, our distractions, our desires, our family, our church, our country, our whatever we think is ours. And most stories are mostly kind of entertaining. They might tell you something about human life. They might be interesting. They might be insightful. This story, though, has stakes, and the stakes are life and death. And the story opens with creation. There are two creation accounts in the Bible. They're back to back, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. It's the same story, but there's two different messages through the retelling. So both of the stories are constructed differently. Genesis 1 describes a God who made everything versus multiple little gods of the sun, of the moon, of the water, of the trees, etc. The point of Genesis 1 is not scientific accuracy or even chronological order. I don't know if you guys remember when we did our series on Simon Peter last year, we talked about how the Bible doesn't order things the way that we, in our culture and time period, like to order things. It doesn't think that chronological order is the most important thing. It orders things according to importance or to try to make a point. And so, you know, we saw some of the stories about Simon Peter happening. You know, we would look at one that actually happened before something we had already looked at. It's more about theme and message than it is about this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And the science thing is not a part of this Genesis 1 at all. It's not supposed to be. The woman who wrote the book Casket that I'm using to help inform this series, Dr. Kaminsky, says, as we begin our journey through the Old Testament, we need to bear in mind that the ancient world was a very religious place. It was religious in that people believed in many gods. This is known as polytheism. Read against this background, the creation story is not setting out to prove to an atheist world that God exists because everybody already believes in gods. But it's establishing in a polytheistic world that there is only one God, the Creator God. So Genesis 1 is arguing a point, but it is not arguing the point that most of us in our enlightenment scientific age are trying to argue. And so it doesn't work to make the arguments that we are trying to make. The argument it's making is, you guys are worshiping a whole bunch of little gods of all these things, but all those things are created. There's only one God, and he made all that. Genesis 1 is a poem, and so it's arranged intentionally like poems are. And you can see it, there's actually a pattern. So day one, God makes light. Day four, he creates the sun, moon, and stars. Day two, he creates the water and the sky. Day five, he creates the birds and the fish. Day three, land and plants. Day six, animals and humans. It's thematic. There's some matching going on. Nobody's trying to make a point here that God created in six literal days. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. That is not what's important to the writer of this chapter. And in Genesis 2, it doesn't even make sense to say that that's the point that Genesis 1 is trying to make, because in Genesis 2, verse 5, it says, there was land, but there were no plants, and in verse 7, God makes the human. So it's not even in the same order in the two chapters, one after the other, right? The point is not for people to say, oh, this is how God created. It was in this order. It was in this way. Because we need to make sure that, you know, God wins over science. That's not the point. The point is God created. There aren't any other gods. There's only one. He made all this stuff. So humanity is part of the good creation. Humanity was created to rule in the creation in God's image. And Dr. Kaminsky says, in order to appreciate the role given to humanity in Genesis 1, 26, and 27, it's important to understand how the term image is used in the ancient world. So we probably know this most, are most familiar with this idea from Egypt, ancient Egypt. Most of us know that the ancient Egyptians believed that their pharaoh was at least a representative of one of their gods, maybe actually one of their gods on earth. But other ancient societies believe this too about their kings. But Dr. Kaminsky says, when God makes human beings in his image, this is a concept that the ancient world understood, but it's not surprising to read that humans are to rule over the cosmos, since this is a royal task befitting those who are made in the image of God. Yet, this is remarkable, since in the ancient world, this position of honor is usually given to individual kings. In the Bible creation story, however, all human beings share in this royal privilege as sons and daughters of the great king. This is awesome. We are created to reflect God, to be God's representatives ourselves in this earth. Genesis 2, as we said, takes a slightly different approach because it's trying to communicate something else. It tells the story in a different order. There's a different emphasis. The emphasis in Genesis 2 is not that there's only one God and God created everything. It is that human beings are created to be in relationship to God. And so we see God getting down on the ground in the mud, making a human being with his hands. And he breathes his own breath into the first human. This is a deeply tender, intimate, loving picture of who God is and who we are in connection to God. We're not just supposed to represent him. We are supposed to be closely in relationship to him. That is how we are able to represent him. Humanity is to rule, and we see that in chapter 2, also naming the animals, that humanity is to fill the cosmos with life. The man and the woman are together, they're naked and they're not ashamed. But also to remain trustingly, contentedly dependent on God, who cares for them, walking with them, providing community for them, each other, and ultimately their children, and giving them food to eat. Awesome. This is pretty cool. So what happens in Genesis 3? The God of love and life has made all things. This is established in Genesis 1 and 2. He has declared all things good. And so he makes humans good in his good image. And he chooses us to have his authority, under his authority, to rule all the rest of creation. We talked about this a little bit a few weeks ago when we talked about stewardship. If you think about it, the prohibition to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is actually the first stewardship project. Everything was good in this garden. Everything was perfect. They didn't need to weed anything. So God is giving them a project, an exercise in self-control and self-denial, which is an exercise in stewardship. This is their first project, their first job. One, you hear that saying, or you see those memes, you had one job. This was it. Okay. But then the serpent shows up. And we don't need to go into exactly who the serpent was, because that's a long topic for another day. But this serpent is another created being who wishes to rule. Does not want the humans to rule. The serpent wants to rule. And the serpent represents the rest of creation, both the physical creation, because it's a serpent, animals, even plants, also represents the spiritual creation, which we usually refer to as angels and demons. The only way for another created being to take over the human's place as representatives of God and rulers on the earth is to cause a rift between humans and the one whose image they are designed to bear. So the first lie, which this is, the serpent says, you won't really die. Did God really say it's effective? Because, first of all, neither of the humans have ever heard an untruth before. Everything was good. They never had a reason to doubt God, because God had always been there for them, had always fulfilled his word. They didn't have a reason to doubt, but it was also effective because it took something true and counterfeited it. With a little dash of FOMO. You guys know what FOMO is? Fear of missing out. There's no kids here today, so except for Benjamin. I'm pretty sure he doesn't have FOMO yet. So there's they're being told that they will receive something that they already have. You will be like God. They're already like God. They're already created in his image. They already have the authority to rule. They're already like God, but they're being offered something and made to think they don't have it. And then the serpent takes it a little further. You'll be like God, able to know good and evil. Oh, we're missing out on something. There's something we don't know. Oh no, it works. Here's an idea that I had just this week. So I'm not going to say I learned this from any other Bible scholar that's more knowledgeable than me, but this is something I'm going to try out because I think it does kind of go with the biblical narrative. I suspect that the more time the man and the woman spent with God, the more they would perceive the world like God did. I suspect at some point in their development with God and connection with God, they would have learned the difference between good and evil because they were designed to reflect God. And he knows. He was just declaring everything good, right? So, and we see, you know, our theme verse from last year, 2 Corinthians 3:18, says that as we contemplate the Lord's glory, we will be transformed into his likeness. So I think if Adam and Eve had continued contemplating the Lord's glory, going for walks with him in the evening, they would have become more and more increasingly like God. But they did not trust that. We don't know what it's like in our existence to not learn things the hard way, because we all have to learn things the hard way. This is just how this world works and how we work in it. But it's possible that when all things were good, we could have learned things not the hard way. Dr. Kaminsky points out that Eve saw that the tree was good, just like God looked over all that he had made and he saw that it was good, but she declared its goodness for herself. It says she saw that the tree was good and that it was good for food and pleasing to the eye, and so she took it and she offered some to her husband. And Kaminsky says, if Adam and Eve are to enjoy life with God, they are required to live by faith, not simply by sight. Obedience to God's command requires Adam and Eve to acknowledge that Yahweh is God and that his word is reliable and true. And we know this is true throughout the Bible. We're going to talk about Abraham next week, and there's a verse in the New Testament that says Abraham was saved by his faith. All Adam and Eve had to do was trust God, and they would have been safe. But they did not. And this is their sin. And there are two ways that we can sin. There's a couple ways to break it down. You can say you can sin by doing something you're not supposed to do, or you can sin by not doing something you're supposed to do. That's one division. But in this case, there are two other ways we can sin. We can be tricked into sinning, or we can rebel. One is accidental and one is on purpose, but both of them are still sin. Eve is tricked. The Apostle Paul tells us in the New Testament, Eve was deceived, Adam was not deceived, which means Adam just, he knew what he was supposed to not do, and he just went ahead and did it anyway. Both humans, both the man and the woman, are equally guilty. And we all have inherited the guilt, and we all behave in the same way. We all sin without realizing it, and we all sin on purpose. And because of this, we are now under a death sentence. And this is not, you could look at it as a punishment, but I don't think that's really what it is. I think when we decide we're going to go our own way, we're going to worship something other than God, we're going to give authority to ourselves or something else, it causes a rift between us and God. And God is life. We don't have life in ourselves, and so when we are separate from God, we're basically dead. Dead in our transgressions. Yes, exactly. So Adam and Eve, in their choice to worship themselves, to try to be like God without God, their idolatry, that caused a rift between them and the author of life, and other rifts, a rift between people. We see it immediately. God finds them and says, "Where are you? And did you eat from the tree?" And Adam says, "Oh, this woman that you gave me, she told me to." And Eve says, "That serpent over there, he told me to." And that shows a rift between us and creation. God immediately says, okay, there's going to be enmity between the woman and the serpent, which is symbolic, and there's definitely some Jesus promise in that verse. That's chapter 3, verse 15. But it also shows that there's friction now between us and the rest of creation. We can't live naturally in harmony with creation very well anymore. Another created being tried to take our authority, and now, we discussed this when we talked about stewardship too, we either abuse creation or we let it abuse us. And there's a rift within ourselves, because we were designed to be connected to God, and if we're separate from God, the image that we were designed to bear is fragmented, broken. So we're broken. We don't work if we're not connected to God. We now experience both good and evil, but on our own, we still can't tell the difference between the two, as long as we remain separate from the God of love and life who created the world good. So we're going to look at the rest of the story, or part of the rest of the story, in the coming weeks. The rest of the story is that the whole Bible is the whole Bible. It's the individuals in it. It's our individual lives too. And it is about the lengths that God will go to win us back. Remember, we've said the good news is that God, that in Jesus Christ, will reconcile all things. He wants to reconcile us. He wants to heal all the rifts between us and him, between us and each other, between us and creation, and within ourselves. He wants us still to fill the earth and steward it with his goodness and light, reflecting his image, just as he created us to do in the first place. And so the rest of the story is also about how resistant we human beings are, how idolatrous, how we will keep trying to worship anything, anyone, other than the true God who loves us, who made us. So today we're going to celebrate communion. Communion is a physical, participatory symbol of the lengths God will go to win our hearts back. Apostle Peter tells us in his first letter that God planned to send Jesus before the foundation of the world, which shows us that none of the story that we're going to look at, that we've already looked at, that we're living in, took him by surprise. Even though God knew that we would cause him pain, because you know that if you love and someone betrays you, that is painful. God knew we were going to betray him. He made us anyway. He loved us so much. He loved so much that he made us anyway. And then he came to save us, to bring us back into relationship with him, to heal the rift. So let's now enter into our solemn but joyful and grateful celebration of the extravagant love of God. But first, let's pray. Lord God, your love is so extravagant, and we are so stubborn, and we are so often blind. We so often miss your presence in our lives and your love for us, and the things that you are trying to work together for our good. We live in a broken world. We broke it. And we struggle and we experience hardship, but any of that stuff you can take and redeem, because you can redeem.